This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, the auto bailout takes center stage in the foreign policy presidential debate.
If we had taken your advice, Governor Romney, about our auto industry, we'd be buying cars from China instead of selling cars to China.
Also, we continue our look at Michigan's film industry as we talk with the director of Michigan's film office.
We've got world-class infrastructure. We've got great studios, great post-production facilities, all of these things. And then we also have a really talented workforce.
But all of that is struggling since the generous tax incentives were cut way, way back. And we discover that one of the hardest working animals in Michigan is the bat. It's under attack, and that could cost us millions and millions of dollars. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up on today's show, we'll continue looking at Michigan's film industry, struggling to get back on its feet after the once generous state tax incentives that lured big Hollywood filmmakers were cut way, way back. And we'll get you thinking about, believe it or not, bats, the way you've probably never thought of them before. These hardworking little animals mean a whole lot more to our state's economy than most of us would have ever believed. But first, three and done. President Obama and Governor Mitt Romney took part in this election's final presidential debate last night in Boca Raton, Florida. Although the debate was focused around foreign policy, the conversation turned to what the Obama campaign thinks is a winning issue for the president, the federal bailout of the domestic auto industry. The issue came up close to the end of the debate when the candidates were talking China and trade.
If we had taken your advice, Governor Romney, about our auto industry, we'd be buying cars from China instead of selling cars to China.
And Romney quickly countered.
Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm a son of Detroit. I was born in Detroit. My dad was head of a car company. I like American cars. And I would do nothing to hurt the U.S. auto industry.
Here now to talk about how the auto bailout played in last night's debate and in this overall presidential campaign is Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Daniel Howes, business columnist for the Detroit News. Jack, Daniel, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Jack, as I mentioned, this was a debate focused on foreign policy, but the president managed to get in the auto bailout. Let's take a listen here.
Under no circumstances would I do anything other than to help this industry get on its feet. And the idea that has been suggested that I would liquidate the industry, of course not. Of course not.
Let's check
That's
the record.
That's the height of silliness. I would liquidate the industry.
Governor,
I want
the people
keep the
of Detroit
going
don't
and
forget.
Thriving.
So the people of Detroit won't forget. Jack? How did that work out for the president?
Well, I think it probably helped him to the extent that people were watching at that point. I think that for poor Mitt Romney, sort of in the position of John Kerry when he said that he voted for the whatever it was before he voted against it, Mitt Romney has been defined as the man who said he'd let Detroit go bankrupt. There's some, of course, that was a headline. There's some nuances involved. And the more he tries to explain it away, I think the more he puts his foot in the tar.
Daniel?
This is something that just drives me around the bend. Number one, Jack's right about the headline in the New York Times. It said, let Detroit go bankrupt. Mitt Romney didn't make that argument. He didn't make that argument in that op-ed. He didn't make that argument in interviews with me and with the Detroit News editorial board. He has talked from the jump about a structured bankruptcy. And when the president says, you said let Detroit go bankrupt, the president took General Motors and Chrysler bankrupt. He ordered it. His task force engineered it. That's what happened. So I think from the jump, he goes down a road that is demonstrably untrue. And if the president says, let's check the record, I've gone back through that op-ed paragraph by paragraph. I've written about it. The truth of the matter is that a lot of what Mitt Romney recommended in November of 2008 is ultimately what the Obama administration did.
However, not quite. Not quite. Not
well,
quite.
Yes,
in fact, your own Detroit News' editorial said when they endorsed Romney in the primary over Santorum, they said he just doesn't get it, that he didn't understand that the companies had to be supported, that there had to be a cushion bankruptcy, that money had been put in, had to be put in before, and he certainly didn't talk about that. Now, it's
well,
an exaggeration.
But in February of this year, in an interview in Livonia, he said it to us on the record that he, if he was president, he would have provided the capital, the bridging capital, to do it. Now, I would stipulate, and I agree with Jack on this point, Romney's discussion on this has been a little bit muddled, going back as you walk it backwards. I think he understands this process better than just about anybody else running for president in God knows how long, because he's done this kind of work. This is what he did in the business, one of the things he did in the private sector. He understands how it works. But I think it is just disingenuous to suggest that his whole MO here was to say, you know, let them go bankrupt. Look at the op-ed. He said they needed to fire management. The president did. He fired Rick Wagner. They said they needed to rationalize the business. They did. There's a whole number of issues that he brings up that, in fact, they did. And what they're using is a single headline to beat him over the head. And I think it also drives home the point how important the industrial Midwest is in this election. And I'm sure you've talked about that with other people. But it's very critical. Michigan, Ohio, are critical battlegrounds, and if this is something that can score them some points, they're going
to
use it.
Let me ask you this, both of you. Clearly, the president wants to keep addressing the bailout and bringing this up. Is this issue really resonating anywhere other than Midwestern states like Michigan and Ohio?
Well, I think the bailout is a very fraught for the president as a political issue, because clearly there are a lot of people out there, many of whom may be Democratic voters who didn't like the concept of the bailout. They don't like what it said, what it did, and I don't think it necessarily scores points. I think it also shows that the thinness of an otherwise weak economic record. If he's pushing this point, it to me suggests a little bit of desperation, but because I don't think it doesn't poll well. There's been polling that I've heard about that even in the state of Michigan, half of the people polled said they were opposed to the bailout.
Jeff, what are your thoughts?
I sort of totally disagree with that. There are places where it is unpopular, and those are mainly southern states that are really not in play in this election. But the sort of feeling, the national feeling that I get is that this is the one thing that really worked, that the bailout took place. The auto companies have paid back a lot of the money, not all the money. There's some grousing about that, but they are profitable again, and there are jobs. And between 1 million and 3 million jobs were saved. So I think where this, the one place in the country where this is really having an effect is Ohio, and especially in Northwest Ohio, where I spend a lot of time. Polls are consistently showing Obama 5-6 points ahead. In a normal close election, Ohio tends to go Republican, but apparently not this time.
I agree with everything you said about the bailout, and I want to make a very important distinction here. I'm not arguing that the bailout was a mistake. My whole point here is, and I agree with Jack. I mean, I think it did save the industry. The industry had when you see what they're doing today, they had something worth saving. They had products and capability and everything worth saving. No question about that.
Exactly.
I don't disagree with that. What my point here is the way in which it is being used inaccurately as a political bludgeon in a presidential campaign.
And really largely from that headline, correct? The way that headline was written, that, as you say, Romney didn't even write that headline.
Yeah, and the other thing that's really important here to remember is he wrote that op-ed in November of 2008. I'm not sure the exact date, but it was coincident to the two very embarrassing hearings in front of Congress where the CEOs went down and just got bloodied. A lot of what he said was subsequently played out going forward. So I think you have to look at this also in context. And a number of the things that he pointed out, the things that he thought needed to be done, as I said, the task force ultimately did in early 2009 by, you know, the firing of Rick Wagner, the putting the companies into bankruptcy with federal support. And we can argue about whether it was federal guarantees. He didn't say federal support, as I remember it. So there's a distinction there. But
there's something else going on. It's not just a headline. If you remember, in February, when Romney was campaigning in Michigan, he would have been well advised, I think, this might not be an issue if he said, look, that's ancient history. We're all happy the companies are alive. Instead, he kept trying to justify his having been against the bailout, tripping over his own tongue. The more he talked, the worse it got. And I think for some voters, there are a lot of footage of Southern senators from Alabama, Senator Corker from Tennessee, just saying gleefully at the end of 2008, let the auto companies die. We don't care. Let them go out of business. And that, if to the extent that's remembered, that isn't helping Republicans in this part of the world.
Well, that's absolutely true.
We're talking with Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Daniel Howes, who's the business columnist for the Detroit News. In our final time here, gentlemen, could you both give us your thoughts. Did last night's debate, or really the series of three debates, change any minds, especially those folks who are still up for grabs who haven't made a final decision?
I think last night was Romney kind of held his own and played it safe. I mean, I don't think he went on the attack as much as I think some people wanted him to, particularly on issues like Libya and a couple of other things. The president was a little bit more aggressive. To the extent the series of debates changed things, I think obviously, and then we've talked about this, the most important one was the first one, where I think Romney played very well. The president seemed unprepared, a lack of energy. And I think the biggest bounce was that one. I don't expect that there's going to be any big bounce either for either candidate coming out of this debate.
Jack?
I think Daniel's right about the first one, about overall. I think had this third debate been the first one, it would be a very different narrative. Romney was very weak in this debate. He looked very bad, I thought. At the end of this debate, they had Carville for the Democrats said, well, the president really won. And Ari Fleischer for the Republicans says, it doesn't matter. It's all domestic policy. So to an extent, this is probably didn't change a lot of minds, but it's probably a game right now where the score is probably 27-24 Obama in the fourth quarter. And this debate certainly didn't get Romney any yardage.
What do you think we should be watching for from these candidates in the final 2 weeks in this last home stretch?
Lots of spending.
And where they are, where they spend their time, I think, is critical. I think I heard something yesterday that was very interesting, is that there's a belief that this whole thing is going to be settled in the industrial Midwest. And I find that kind of delicious in some senses, that, on the coasts and other places that tend to view us as flyover country, that ultimately the people in Ohio and Michigan and other states like that are going to decide who the next president is.
Daniel's absolutely right. Both these guys should be paying taxes in Ohio. But if you don't see them coming to Michigan, if you don't see Romney coming to Michigan, that means they're not taking seriously their chances of winning Michigan. I don't think Michigan really is in play. Ohio, Wisconsin, Iowa, Colorado are very much in play. Virginia, and that's where this race will be decided.
That's right. And the president, I think there was some talk earlier in the week that he might even pull out of Florida. Virginia is tight for him, which I think is not a good sign. So it's going to be Ohio, Ohio, all the time, Ohio, including my hometown, which has been one that's picked the winner every time since for the, 100 years.
Which one is that?
Canton, Ohio.
Canton, Ohio. County.
Yep.
Daniel Howes, Detroit News, and Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. As always, enjoy talking with you. Thanks for joining us on Stateside.
It's a pleasure.
My pleasure.
It's still to come. Why watching the presidential debates just might smack a little of watching Dancing with the Stars? And what are the new tougher graduation requirements doing to Michigan's high school students? That story coming up in 10 minutes on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the final debate of the presidential campaign of 2012 heads into the history books, let's look at what these debates and the presidential campaigns say about American culture. Michael Lembert is a linguistic anthropologist at the University of Michigan. He's the co-author of Creatures of Politics, Media, Message, and the American Presidency. Michael, you say that these big debate events and the campaigns provide a unique window into our society.
Debates are part of what is really a large-scale character contest. In our book, what we detail, what we explore, are the dynamics of what's called message. Message is a political insider term. It's something, a term that started to be used in the early 1990s. And it's a term, the term itself is new. What it describes isn't. It's old, and it's something that my co-author, Michael Silverstein, and I argue is at the center of U.S. electoral politics and how it works. So the term message sounds like it ought to mean what candidates literally say, the points they make in debate, the stances and positions they take on issues. But in fact, it's a mischievous term.
It's mischievous. And,
right. It directs attention to that. Campaigns themselves would have us think that their candidates are made solely of issues. But it's not. The term also means the kind of character presented to the electorate. And so debates, one thing that they reveal, these are sites in which candidate character is at stake. And that's the dynamics of that are something that we explore in our book.
And let me talk about last night. What particularly made you sit up and go, hey, as you were watching?
A flashback to 2004.
How so?
one irony among many is that Obama pulled out the flip-flopper attack. President Obama used the flip-flopper attack on Romney precisely on issues of national security, saying things that sounded exactly like lines that Bush used against Kerry in 2004. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
You'll recall just – I know this is some time ago – back in 2004, the GOP launched negative campaigns against Kerry in the lead-up to the first debate in 2004, which was on foreign policy. And they had this one of the most effective attack ads featuring him windsurfing on Nantucket to the tune of Blue Danube, changing his positions, and of course at the culmination is how can he lead if he doesn't know where he stands?
Yes, I remember.
And so we see Obama, last night saying things similar to what Bush said, which is if you're not clear about where you stand, if you're all over the map, how can you possibly lead? So strength, strong leadership, to project that, it also involved critiques of his candidate as being a flip-flopper. And it's very interesting that at least one thing I sensed is precisely this convergence, even though Obama was trying to suggest, of course, that with Mitt Romney we're going back in time to kind of Bush era. So if, on the one hand, he's saying you're going to go back to Bush with selecting Romney, he was using attacks similar to Bush that were used in the 2004 presidential debate on foreign policy. It was fascinating, actually.
I want to ask your thoughts on what you believe mm-hmm. goes into that carefully created package mm-hmm. of a presidential candidate, because that is all part of that
right.
message, isn't it? So what elements?
One of the most extraordinary things is that, and this is something that I think all of us should take notice of, is that not just speech, but also gesture, comportment, clothing, hairstyle, even eyeglass frames. Think of the titanium frame eyewear of Sarah Palin. Any of this stuff, these materials, can be treated as revelatory, as windows onto who the candidates really are. And of course, we know that if you look at the kinds of coverage of candidates, we see these signs that candidates giving out being treated as if they're revelatory. So we find that to be fascinating. As somebody who carefully studies face-to-face interaction, as somebody who also looks at gesture, of course, I'm interested in what candidates try to do to project particular character. I mean, what does it look like to project strength, for example? Mm-hmm. How do you act that out? But I'm also interested in the predatory voyeurism that our coverage sometimes looks like. I mean, sometimes I feel as if I'm watching TMZ, where candidates are being treated as celebrities in sometimes the worst sense.
Is this whole thing kind of a function of the way that our nation gobbles up American Idol and Dancing with the mm-hmm. Stars and The Voice, and we want judging and thumbs up and thumbs down? Is mm-hmm. that a function of our obsession with celebrity?
I think there's a fascinating overlaps between presidential candidacy and celebrityhood. I mean, there's several different senses in which celebrity plays into political campaigns. I mean, think first in the most simplest sense of the aura, of the rubbing off, the prestige by association one gets about having Hollywood celebs or music stars nearby. We can think of the titillating back and forth between Jack Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe, mm-hmm. or think, of course, of the fierce competition to recruit to your campaign rallies, musicians who have visibility. Think of the Bubba and the Boss mm-hmm. Tour and the like. So there's that. There's the prestige by association. That's one. Two, there's also, of course, the rarer case of career trajectories where people start off celebrity, end up politician. Of course, Ronald Reagan,
yes.
Arnold the Governator, Schwarzenegger, Fred Thompson's Law mm-hmm. and Order, Jesse the Body Ventura. Third, there's ways in which candidates themselves can try to smuggle in a sense of celebrityhood. Think of Timothy Pawlenty's the crafting of this name T-Paul, right, mm. on the model of J-Lo, K-Fed, right, A-Rod. But I think beyond what candidates and campaigns do, there's ways in which we're consuming this coverage that starts to look awfully like, as I said, in its extremes, something like TMZ, where every foible, every peccadillo, is magnified and subject to scrutiny through a kind of predatory voyeurism. And so one of the things we want to do is stand back and observe that and ask take note of that as being part of how electoral politics works today.
What did you see watching last night's debate? You've talked about how important gestures and mm-hmm. comportment and appearance are. Break down each candidate and give me your impressions from what you saw.
I mean, to do this carefully, mm-hmm. One really needs to – I mean, I work with video data, mm-hmm. Which I'm coding gestures, and this takes a kind of careful – quite a bit of careful work. Most people who fill the role of, like, color commentator, who are trotted on the scene, body language experts, offer impressionistic evaluations of candidates without carefully looking at this material. What I can tell you some differences between the first and the second.
Yes.
Okay, let me start with that, and then we can talk a bit about the third. So a lot of the reporting after the first debate, you had these reports out about Obama looking anemic, lacking energy, mm-hmm. Not bringing fight.
Looking at Governor Romney, but looking down at the podium.
Yeah, this was exacerbated, especially for the CNN.com, at least, coverage. You had at the bottom of the screen a sort of, had the Colorado undecideds, how they felt, supposedly,
yes.
Right, being tracked. So you couldn't even see what he was doing with his hands. It was just looked like his eyes were staring downward. So you had this characterization of him looking weak, looking anemic. In the second, what was something that really is striking about in the second debate, you see, besides, I mean, a lot of people have commented on the pointing gestures. They've commented on what he was doing in terms of his bodily comportment, mm-hmm. with respect to Romney. But what I noticed is, and I tested this, was a dramatic increase of what's called power grip. Power grip is a type of gesture. So Obama was holding the microphone with his right hand. With his left hand, imagine just closing your fist, mm-hmm. and putting your thumb over your fist and sort of shaking it up and down as if you were hammering something.
Yes.
Right.
You've
so and SNL actually, of course, if you looked at them, they picked up on the frequency of that. And that he was doing about 25% of his manual gestures in that second debate were power gripped. Only about 10% in the first debate. But in addition, he was doing a lot of these low to medium amplitude strokes, this hammering motion, mm-hmm. both with a pointed finger, with the power grip, and with other gestures. And that, I think, is one of the ways in which he was projecting a certain degree of intensity, even antagonism. Certainly, and you, I mean, that kind of motion was something that I didn't see nearly as robustly in that first debate. So you can see how the gesturally he was responding. Okay. Another thing that was conspicuously absent from the first debate is what's called precision grip. So imagine you're picking up something really small, like where your thumb, tip of your thumb touches the tip of your index, mm-hmm. finger. Okay, mm-hmm. And that's often used to make a fine or precise point. It's really used to kind of highlight something you're talking about. It's like a highlighter.
Yes.
But when candidates are anxious to kind of make a sharp, effective point, they tend to use it robustly. Obama, let's just flash back to 2007, mm-hmm. just for a second. In the first couple of debates of 2007, the primary debates, he was criticized as lacking specifics, looking gauzy and abstract, all sizzle and no steak. And when his campaign took stock of that, you see him in subsequent debates using precision grip a lot.
So he was coached.
Right. So, my colleague Michael Silverstein, University of Chicago, quipped after our first debate this year, has President Obama lost his grip? And indeed, the only 1% of his manual gestures in that first debate were featured precision grip. So he was really off his, I think, game in a number of different respects. And it's fascinating to see how candidates recuperate.
I had to wonder, though, in that first debate, he had a podium. He clearly, mm-hmm. had a pad. And I've seen this with lawyers, even when I've interviewed them. As soon as you begin to talk, they start taking notes, just like they do in court. And I wonder if some of that was what was at play, mm-hmm. the first debate, where the second debate, they could move around the ring like a couple of prize fighters. No pens, mm-hmm. no pads, and no podiums.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating what sense people make of avoidance, what they perceive to be avoidance of eye gaze. So yes. What's the significance of gaze direction? You remember last night, of course,
yes.
Obama kept his gaze trained on Romney for, mm-hmm. much of it. And for us, it's not only a question of what is the candidate trying to do. It's what sense do people make of that after the fact? I mean, these are details. Not all details are relevant to message. Mm-hmm. Only some of them are. And what's fascinating for us is sort of how people pick up on this, note it, and then use it to expose message. Same thing, I mean, look at the interpersonal, the treatment of the moderator in the second debate, how that became important. Right, here's a female moderator. Mm-hmm. And people were scrutinizing that relationship and treating that as a window onto how the candidate may be positioning women. So some of these, not all details, but some of the details get preyed upon in commentary. and they're used to make sense of who can, what candidates are really up to. And this is where the role, I think, where professional commentators come in. I mean, I'm always struck by post-debate commentary. You have reporters coming up and asking pundits, so what was Obama really trying to show here? What was Governor Romney really trying to do here? The commentariat, as some irreverent people call them,
yes.
play a critical role in reading message for us. They lift out, unveil underlying message and make that available to voters. So they're like color commentators in a certain sense. Of it. Apology for the sports analogy.
Right. Dare I wonder, are they like Len, Bruno, and Carrie Ann on Dancing with the Stars, where you know somebody finishes it and then they're holding up their score and giving their impressions?
Right,
are they crucial?
Well, I think some people, of course, worry about partisanship and the ways in which one superficial way, although important way of looking at this, is to what degree are their evaluations disinterested, or what degree are they partisan? Are they kind of inviting us to evaluate candidates in ways that either support their message or go against it? But I think a deeper way thing, they're playing a critical role that I think is underappreciated, is they are the interpreters of message. They're offering expert commentary. I mean, candidates don't reveal what their message is. It's not like they say, "I'm now going to, I'm now going to be strong and exhibit strong, strong leadership here." They enact it, but they don't tell you what they're doing. But what the commentators come in and do is they supposedly expose that message for us. So they're playing a critical role. They're like, if you imagine tiered concentric circles, like a pebble dropped into water, radiating out, mm-hmm. they form this kind of ring between the political campaigns and us. And I think that role of the professional commentators really needs to be understood if you want to understand how message works.
In the time we have, I want to ask you about a mm-hmm. term that your co-author, Michael Silverstein, mm-hmm. coined, and that was ethno-blooperology. And you spent a lot of time talking about Bush 43, George W. Bush's mm-hmm. bloopers, and you're saying those were not accidental?
Well, there's a certain purchase you can – one of the things I was fascinated by in 2004 is – I mean, he was known for his misspeakfulness.
Yes, right? His misspeakfulness.
There's a whole archives of Bushisms available
yes.
on the web.
Yes.
But, it's extraordinary that there's something charming and disarming, actually, about some of this. There's a way in which some of those can project ordinariness against the patrician effete, right, overly crafted kind of demeanor of Kerry. So in contrast to someone like Kerry, some of that misspeaking actually kind of didn't hurt him. It kind of arguably helped him in some respects. Now, what Michael, I think my colleague mm-hmm. Silverstein has looked at as well, are look at the way in which articulatory fumblings of many sorts, gaffes, bloopers, the way these are seized upon and treated as revelatory. You know, Romney, for example, talking about Osama bin Laden, but accidentally referring to Obama.
And actually, Bob Schieffer did that last night. He said Obama bin Laden. Everybody was tweeting about that
when
it happened.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Of course. What's fascinating is how people seize upon them and read into them. I mean, there were Machiavellian readings. Oh, this was a deliberate misspeaking meant to slander kind of Obama and show that he's weak on terror and so on and so forth. There's others that treat it in a kind of Freudian way. Mm-hmm. And now there's, in fact, I think it's almost become a scripted move. Think about the way in which you trot out your vice president and say, meet the next president of the United mm-hmm. States. It's become a canned move where people are even performing slips for us. So I think it's a fascinating diagnostic of where our electoral politics is at.
Fascinating insights from Michael Lembert, a linguistic anthropologist at the University of Michigan and co-author of the book Creatures of Politics, Media, Message, and the American Presidency. Thanks for sharing your insights with us today, Michael.
It was a pleasure.
A new study serves up some arguably disappointing results for Michigan's tougher new high school academic standards, the Merit Curriculum. It was unveiled in 2006, designed to strengthen academic performance. Michelle Richard joins us now. She's an educational specialist with Public Sector Consultants. So, Michelle, the class of 2011, it's the first group of students to be exposed to the Merit Curriculum. Did it do what it was supposed to do?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily characterize the results as disappointing. I think that we still aren't sure yet. This is some good interim data that, from my perspective, tells us that we aren't done implementing, that we still have work to do in our schools to make sure that the Merit curriculum is doing everything it can for Michigan students.
So, bottom line, how did the students with already strong skills fare?
Yeah, so students who came to high school with strong skills already did well. They didn't do notably better in terms of graduation rates than they had previously, but we did see some improvements in their standardized test scores.
And the weaker skills students?
They didn't do nearly as well. Now, to me, this is a storyline that we have heard before. Our schools struggle to support our weakest students. And I think that simply implementing a new curriculum isn't going to fix that on its own.
So is the merit curriculum doing what it's supposed to do? If we didn't see any real change in graduation levels for students with strong skills and with students with weaker skills, some wound up not completing high school, is it working as intended?
I think that we still need to wait to see. What the Michigan merit curriculum tried to do was to raise our standards so that our students would be graduating more prepared for college and career. We know that colleges and employers are not lowering their standards for Michigan students. I think what this report really tells us is that we have more work to do in our schools to make sure that every student can meet the expectations that our school system has set and that colleges and employers have set.
And that work really needs to be done at those really early grades, isn't it? So they're building a stronger foundation.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, this is the first cohort of students who had made it through the Michigan Merit Curriculum. So these are students who were ninth graders in 2007. The Michigan Merit Curriculum was passed in 2006. That means that those elementary and middle school teachers that had the students that graduated in 2011, they didn't understand the expectations that our high schools would have for them. My hope is that as our lower grades better understand what students need to be successful in our high schools, that they will arrive in high school with stronger academic records, more prepared to succeed.
Thanks so much, Michelle Richard with Public Sector Consultants.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, if contemplating bats gives you an ooky feeling, we're betting you're going to have a change of heart after our next conversation. Those hardworking little bats are under attack. That's in 10 minutes on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing now our look at the film industry in Michigan. Yesterday, we got the view from Michigan-based actor Peter Carey. Today, we welcome Carrie Jones. She's the outgoing executive director of the Michigan Film Office.
Producers love Michigan because they can come in and they can land at the airport in 30 minutes. They can be in the cutest small town they've ever seen. They can be in an urban area or they can be in rural farmland. We've got world-class infrastructure. We've got great studios, great post-production facilities, all of these things. And then we also have a really talented workforce. We have a great story to tell, so that's one of my main roles of my job is to be able to tell that story.
And the second part of her job is to administer the film industry incentives. Carrie, you've just begun the new fiscal year for the film office. So it's fiscal 2013, and the purse is actually fatter than it was in fiscal 2012 in terms of incentives?
It is. So we started this fiscal year with about $58 million. We had a project that pulled out last minute, and so we were able to roll that money forward. So we have 58, which is a good sum. And so I think that we're going to really be able to attract a lot of really great projects. We've had scouts in from major studios looking at Michigan the last several weeks, and people are excited about it. This year was definitely a rebuilding year for us, but the people that came in had good experiences, and so I think that's really setting the stage in a nice way for next year.
Now, Michigan is one of 40 states plus District of Columbia to offer subsidies to film and television producers. So we've got that $58 million, which is not quite where it was when Michigan was absolutely at one point tops in the nation before the program was scaled back. So where does that $58 million that is available right now, where does that put us in the running in the pack?
It still puts us in the top 10. So, we were at one point, we were number one in the nation. Mm-hmm. Now we're still in the top 10. I mean, we're really competitive with states like Georgia, North Carolina, Massachusetts, even, Louisiana gets, is right now they get the most production in the country, probably other than New York and California. But we're still pretty competitive with them because we've got, in addition to our incentive, which is really competitive, those other things I mentioned, our infrastructure, our workforce, and our locations really are attractive to people.
Now, that 50 million, I know it's 50 million plus you had the 8 million that
Correct.
Was left on the table. That's for this fiscal year. What we hear from people, for example, like Peter, when he was talking with us yesterday, the concern in the community of crew, technical, and performing people is that's just for this fiscal year, and producers don't know what will be available next year, the following fiscal year. I guess I'm curious, is there a way of being able to lock in a set figure so that they could build and go forward instead of kind of wondering each year how much might it be to make it stronger?
Right, right. Well, the way that our program is set up is that it is an annual appropriation. So
right.
at this point, we are going, you know, annually. But I think, you know, our legislation, it has a 5-year sunset. So, we've got that consistency that people are, you know, taking comfort in.
In this, explain that to me.
Oh, yeah. So we have the legislation that was signed into law last December it governs our program. It says what our program is, how much of an incentive we're going to give, all of those things. And that is in effect until the end of 2017. So while we don't know how much money we'll have every year, we know that we've got a program that's in place until 2017.
There's certainly no doubt, and you put it delicately, it was a kind of a rebuilding year this past year. And we have certainly heard from the performers and from people who are in the technical side of things that the flood of productions dried to a trickle once the cap, that unlimited cap went away, and it was scaled back. Now, I remember hearing the argument that we were losing 72 cents for every dollar of credit issued based on this study done by Ernst & Young. There was that net loss in tax revenue. But when you looked at that multiplier effect, that indirect spending and the induced spending that those credits generated in hotels and restaurants and the businesses, that Ernst & Young study said each dollar of tax credit generated $5.92 in new Michigan business sales and $2.05 in additional resident income. How was that not a good thing to continue as was for Michigan and its people?
Well, I think that it's, with that study, it depends on, you know, what side you're looking at it from.
Sure.
And with a lot of studies that you can, you know, if you're looking at what revenue is coming back to the state versus, you know, what the multiplier is.
Yes.
And so, you know, I think that that was a determination made by, that we wanted to look at what tax revenue was coming back, and that, you know, and it wasn't as strong of a return as some of the other programs. So that determination was made. But I think that, you know, big picture, the thing to look at is that with $25 million, we had 20% of all of the state's business incentives. With $50 million, we have 30% of all of the state's business incentives. So the film incentive program is – looking at it statewide is still a very prominent program. That may not be the right word, but it is a priority program. You know, 30% of every incentive in the state, I mean, that's a lot. So any money that's going to bring in, you know, advanced manufacturing companies or, you know, any kind of company, you know, we're getting 1/3 of all of that. And that's substantial. Mm-hmm.
I was an extra on Real Steel. It was the fall of 2010, and then I was an extra on Ides of March in spring of 2011. And it really hit me. There were so many people who were getting work because of those productions, whether it be – I talked to a lot of folks who had been laid off from the auto industry who were putting on suits and dresses and showing up to be extras in Real Steel. They had a place to go every day, and for weeks and weeks, actually, they had work with that. There were wardrobe people. There were stylists. There were caterers. There were security guards. Certainly the Michigan-based actors. I guess what would you say to those folks who did feel like the chair got kicked out from under them when the program was retrenched and they were left twisting in the wind, in a sense, because the work is not there the way it was? What would you say to those folks?
Yeah, I am so excited about where we're headed. I mean, some of the projects that we've been talking to, and, you know, they haven't applied yet, so I can't really say anything.
Sure.
But, I mean, we have got such great things coming, and I'm really excited about it. And so I think that people are going to see they're going to see a lot of production in their neighborhoods again. They're going to see a lot of they're going to see a lot of celebrities, you know,
okay,
at our local, you know, eateries and watering holes. So, you know, I think that there's something really fun in addition to, you know, the jobs and things created about having a production in your community and having the productions in the state. And, you know, with the productions that I know that are looking at us seriously and that we anticipate getting applications in for pretty soon, it's going to be an exciting year. 2013 will be fun.
People are going to be seeing a difference, and it'll be because you certainly saw it all around Michigan in like 2009, 2010, 2011. You know, you get stories, there's Gerard Butler at the Michigan State game, you know, kinds
right,
of things.
Exactly.
So they are getting out and about, and they did get a chance then. What I'm hearing is they did get that chance to see Michigan and what Michigan had to offer.
Right. No, and they love it. Like, the actors, the producers, everybody that comes in loves it. So we had Low Winter Sun, which is the AMC pilot, was here, and they wrapped a couple weeks ago. But they just loved Michigan. And the way that they talked about, you know, they're in Detroit, they're headquartered in Detroit, the way that they talked about Detroit, the way that they talked about Michigan people, I mean, it is, you know, there is something so special about this state. And I think that, you know, people just pick up on that. It's our work ethic, but it's also just this, you know, there's just something really special about people from Michigan. And so it's, you know, you've got all of these people who are, I think, you know, it's within our DNA to be creative and to be entrepreneurial and to be doing all of these things. And so, you know, it's really great to be able to showcase that. And then they love coming back because who can blame them?
Now for local, for Michigan-based filmmakers, what would you say? Is there, dare I say, preference given? Is there an expedited, a closer look or a faster
well,
track for local?
You know, we are so excited about, I mean, our indigenous film community in Michigan. And even, you know, this year where the, you know, by in our rebuilding year, there's been so much Michigan production and there's so many creative and smart and passionate people here. And we love being able to help them. You know, we incentivize Michigan projects and are thrilled to be able to do so for those people that just need that little extra help to get their project going. So, you know, this year we've had a number of really great Michigan projects that we've been able to support, and we're really excited about it and we'll continue to do so. But, you know, we still put them through the same, you know, everybody goes through kind of the same paces. We make sure you have your money. We want to see, you know, make sure you're hiring lots of Michigan people, all those things.
Carrie, where do you see Michigan's film industry, let's say, in 5 years?
You know, I think that we are going to, if I'm looking into my crystal ball,
exactly.
You know.
Surely.
I think that we are going to continue on a steady course. I think that the production levels that we had, you know, in 2010, we won't be there again. But I think it'll be more than we were at this year as well. So I think that we will continue to grow our production. And, again, I'm really optimistic about heading into the future. I think we've got a lot of really good things happening.
Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside, Carrie.
Great. Thank you so much.
Carrie Jones is the outgoing executive director of the Michigan Film Office. Margaret O'Reilly takes over as Michigan's film chief on October 29th. Okay, quick. What's the first thing you think of when I say the word bat? It's getting close to Halloween after all, so maybe you think of bat decorations or Bela Lugosi as Dracula. Wildlife biologist Dr. Alan Curta of Eastern Michigan University would like us all to know if those are the kinds of images that come to mind when we think of bats, we're sorely mistaken. In fact, bats are hardworking, important members of our ecosystem, and right now they are under siege by a devastating disease that's threatening the very existence of bats. It's called white nose syndrome. This disease is already north of Sault Ste. Marie in Ontario, and it's in the Akron area of Ohio, although it has yet to reach Michigan. Dr. Curta, you say white nose syndrome is the most significant wildlife calamity ever in North America? How so?
Well, it is, but you have to understand that we've had calamities before, like the bison disappearing and passenger pigeons being decimated. But we're dealing with a disease that is potentially going to wipe out numerous species. And that's what makes it different from past events.
And the reason it's such a significant calamity in terms of dollars and cents is because of what bats mean to agriculture, which I think the general public is really not aware of. So can you enlighten us?
Well, there was an article recently in a journal called Science that tried to estimate the value that bats have to agriculture. And what they came up with was, I believe for Michigan, was something like $500 million per year is the value to Michigan of having bats around to consume crop pests, which then means that you have a greater crop harvest. And it also means that the farmers don't have to spend as much money on pesticides. So there's a lot of benefit that comes from having these animals around. And that article never even considered, though, forest pests as well. And so it's quite possible that in terms of dollars, they're even more valuable in the state because we do have a lot of income. A lot of people rely on the forest industry.
First of all, tell us how white-nose syndrome harms bats, why it's such a deadly disease.
Well, white-nose syndrome is caused by a fungus. It's a fungal disease of the skin. And that fungus has been named Geomyces destructans because of what it does to the bats. And there's a lot of hypotheses as to exactly why it irritates the bats, but it does. Now, that could be that it disrupts the skin so they lose water too frequently. It could just be an irritant that they wake up from hibernation to kick in their immune system. Whatever the reason is, they are waking up from hibernation too frequently.
And what happens when they do that?
Well, see, most animals then, they're not hibernating throughout the winter period. They wake up periodically. And in general, for example, one of our little brown bats will wake up about every 2 weeks. But what is occurring with bats that are infected with white-nose syndrome is they're waking up once every week instead, every 5 to 7 days. Now, in order to go from a hibernating temperature of about, let's say, 45 degrees, raise their body temperature up to 98, 99 degrees, keep it there for an hour or two, and then go back into hibernation. In order to do that requires as much energy, fat that they have stored.
Yeah.
It requires as much energy as they would use up in 60 days of continuous hibernation at a low body temperature. So these arousals are very expensive in terms of energy, in terms of the fat that's stored. And because they're waking up so frequently, they run out of fat come late February, early March, way before there's any flying insects out there that they can eat.
So, and then they're hungry. They're out there looking for insects.
Right. They will actually leave the mine or the cave and start flying around even though there's 3 feet of snow on the ground still. And so ultimately they're dying of starvation.
Is there anything that can be done for infected bats?
Well, nobody's found the magic bullet
okay.
just yet. There are a number of chemicals that people are looking at that will potentially kill a fungus, but you have to make sure that the chemical's not going to kill the bat itself.
Right.
And then you have to figure out how do you deliver that chemical to hundreds of thousands of tiny little animals.
That are hibernating in little nooks and crannies right. where it's very, very dark. All right, so you're looking for this fungus. So far, it has not come into Michigan, but it certainly seems like it is closing in, almost like a pincher-like
exactly.
from north and south. Can it be prevented? Can Michigan's bats be protected in any way from this? They don't have a magic bullet drug.
Well, the two ways in which it is being spread are by the bats themselves and by humans, and there's not much that we can do about spread from bat to bat. Mm-hmm. I think that we have been lucky so far because of where most of our bats hibernate, and that's in the mines of the Western Upper Peninsula. And those mines are a long distance away from the cave areas of the United States where many bats hibernate. It's just a long ways from any other hibernating population. So I think that isolation and the Great Lakes are probably helping delay the arrival of that fungus, because bats don't typically fly that long distance like east to west across Lake Huron, for
All
example.
Right. So they've got some protection thanks to the Great Lakes.
Right. So that's probably one reason why it has not gotten here yet. So the other mode of transmission is by people. And indeed, that's probably how the fungus got to North America in the first place. One of the ways in which they're trying to slow the spread, you can't do anything about keeping the bats
No.
from flying, but you can try to keep people outside of the hibernacula where bats are going to be in the wintertime.
Dr. Curta, tell us what it is that has you so drawn to bats. I know they've really been an important part of your work for many, many years. And what initially just captured your imagination?
You have to understand that bats are just such neat creatures. There are so many things about them that are different. They echolocate at night. They have the largest babies of all mammals. So the equivalent of a 100-pound human female having a 25-pound baby every time. That's what our bats are doing, and that's small. Sometimes it will get up to be 50% of the mother's weight, not just 25%. They're very small animals. The smallest mammal in the world is probably a bat. rat that weighs 2 grams. That's the weight of a penny. Mm-hmm. Despite being so small, they live a long time. The longest-lived mammals in the Great Lakes region are our bats, the little brown bat with record longevity up to 34 years in the wild. So there's just all sorts of neat things about them.
Dr. Ellen Curta, Eastern Michigan University wildlife biologist and Batman. I had to do it. Sorry. Thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Caddy. Thanks for listening. Let's talk tomorrow at 3:00.